Okay, welcome to a new episode. This time, not from Europe, but actually from Hong Kong. So we are kind of skipping around Asia. And with me today, I have Jeffrey Young. Hello.
Hello.
And the topic of the episode is actually LGBTQ rights in Hong Kong. So we're getting quite specific regionally this time. And hopefully maybe we can also talk a bit about LGBTQ rights, kind of like in comparison to the mainland in Taiwan.
Yeah.
So Jeffrey, you're currently in your pupillage, is that
what it's called? So it's a pupillage, so which means that I'm basically training to become a lawyer. But a barrister in the common law tradition. Yeah. So
And so we actually met in the UK in Oxford when you were studying. You did a master's in law there.
Yeah.
Okay. Can you? What was your? Did you focus on anything LGBTQ related there
My thesis was on discrimination law, so it was a comparison between transgender and disability discrimination law, and something more theoretical from that, which I wouldn't bore anyone with.
Okay. So one thing that I'm quite interested in the first place is kind of like helping people maybe better understand a bit what it is like to be LGBTQ in Hong Kong, because generally a lot of people have the impression that it's probably okay. A lot of people have this impression Hong Kong looks very open, it's a bit like a Western metropolis, so probably everything is fine. From talking to people who are actually from here, I don't get that impression. Maybe you can enlighten me a bit in that regard.
So the so what happens in Hong Kong is that the only good thing we have in Hong Kong is that we've gotten rid of the criminalization. So we've gotten rid of that colonial legacy of criminalization of gay sex. But apart from that, we don't have anything else.
Well, okay.
So we don't have a discrimination law. We don't have marriage equality, obviously. We don't have we don't have recognition for trans people. We don't have anything else. Social attitudes. In terms of social attitudes, we have basically a fusion of westernized attitudes and something Chinese society. So something confusion related. So for example, families are quite important. For example, it's really important for a man to bear his family name and to procreate so that his family name can go down the line. So cultural attitudes like that do happen. But then in the past, I think that there's been a long history of activism, of LGBTQ activism in Hong Kong. So people have been working very hard to loosen the attitudes. And I think in the past few years, there have been considerable success, because one important reason is because of all the developments around the world. So Hong Kong is a very open city, so it's very open to information from around the world. So basically, for example, when the US legalized same-sex marriage, it was headlines in Hong Kong, and people, a lot of people on social media changed their profile pictures to become rainbow. So they are very alert to what it means to be a metropolitan, a cosmopolitan, westernized society. Yeah. So in that sense, people's attitudes have changed a lot, and there have been celebrities who came out of the closet.
Could you maybe name some?
For example, Denise Ho.
Yeah,
Anthony Wong.
Yeah.
And then a few others as well. And then recently there's also Ellen Liu. Ellen Liu is also, so she came out in Taiwan, actually. She got the award in basically the Taiwan version of Oscars. She got an award for original music score or something like that. And when she received the award, she announced on stage that she thanks her wife, she married. And then we see more and more of these cases.
Yeah.
So generally, there's actually quite a lot of support, especially among the young, for LGBT rights and in terms of acceptance. But then the government doesn't do anything, and also the acceptance is somewhat superficial, in the sense that people think that, oh, we're liberal, we're supposed to be liberal, that's why we should be accepting. But then there's still a lot of people who can't come out, and I still know a lot of people who hasn't come out.
To their parents, even like younger friends.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. So there are more people who are out, but there's still a lot of people who are not out, or at least they would not openly admit it.
So I want to kind of like, because this whole thing about like the Confucian values and like bearing a son, that's kind of like, it's a bit of a cliche about China as well. So can we maybe talk about what that means in practice?
What it means is that, so for example, when I Well, it didn't exactly come out to my mom, but my mom discovered. I still don't know how she discovered. It still bugs me. But when she discovered, then clearly the thing that worries her most was that I wouldn't have a son.
Right.
And so part of it would be family honor, but that probably didn't bother my mom too much. It may bother my dad more, but it wouldn't bother my mom too much. But what my mom was basically saying that, so you would never get married, so you won't have a son. So,
right,
you won't
so
have someone.
She sat down with you and talked about that.
Yeah, like, so you wouldn't have someone taking care of you when you're old. Mm. So that's why she's really worried. So that's because of all the values that the son is supposed to be the one taking care of the parents when they get old.
Right.
And there's also an element of family honor, which affects those who are more traditional, but right. not necessarily those who are more liberal. But then it also ties in with generally how limited social welfare is in
right.
Hong Kong.
Right, I was going to ask that. Yeah. So, like, are you reliant on your children for essentially doing well in old age? Like, to what extent are you...
I think that this is something that's tied into the wider political issues in Hong Kong, because, for example, Hong Kong doesn't have a pension system, basically. And people have been fighting for a pension system for a long time, but then one of the strongest arguments from the other side of the government side is that is they're basically saying that, well, if when you get old, you should then your son or your son and daughter should be taking care of you, and so why should the government be taking care of you?
Right.
So we can see how these kind of family values get sipped into political debates, and it also affects LGBT rights.
So there's also this fusion with like Western influence, because Hong Kong was a British colony for exactly 99 years, right?
No, well, it was a British colony for longer than that.
Okay.
It was a British colony for I think 150 years.
Oh,
it's just that part of the territory was ceded for 99 years.
Okay.
So
one thing that I always notice when I'm here is that you see a lot of like Christian symbols, things like really big neon crosses and things like that. So how much of a role does Christianity and religion play in that regard?
I think this is something that we can really blame colonialism, because because of colonialism, it brought along with them ministers and Christianity. And one of the foundational role that Christianity plays in Hong Kong is they dominate the provision of social services.
Mm-hmm.
So they have a lot of schools. Most of the top schools in Hong Kong have Christian backgrounds.
Right, yeah.
They deliver a lot of social services. And this means that there is a stronghold of, for example, the people who go into government, who are often from these schools. This means that they have a lot of power when they negotiate with the government. And recently, we also have more and more of American evangelism.
Oh.
So there's
new stuff coming over.
Yeah, there's new stuff coming over. But then this stuff comes to Asia in general.
Yeah, yeah.
So Hong Kong is just, we've seen that.
Yeah.
And the thing with American evangelicals is that they have huge churches. They have mega churches. And this has an impact, because in Hong Kong, we have a government that's not elected, and which means that they rely on other avenues of political support.
Mm-hmm.
And when you have mega churches who are willing to work with the government, so they provide the necessary support that the government has. So this is some kind of an unholy marriage between the government and these mega churches.
Right.
So this is how they have a disproportionate sway, even though they're only, I think, 20% of the population who are Christians.
Which is already... only 20%?
About that, 20 or 30%.
I'll check for statistics.
I'm sure you can find statistics. But but they have a disproportionate influence in the government.
Yeah. And another thing that you also mentioned at the beginning, but I think it's worth talking about, is this paragraph that essentially criminalized same-sex sex.
Right.
Which is a holdover from colonialism that almost every... Like, Singapore still has it, for example, right? Like, and so this, how long did you have this paragraph in Hong Kong? When was it abolished, you know?
It was actually, I don't actually know when exactly it was introduced in Hong Kong, but I know it was for a long time.
Yeah.
And it was abolished actually by the colonial government in 1991.
Oh.
So few years before the handover, it was actually, I've actually gone through legislative debates of that, and the government initiative to abolish that actually triggered the start of the LGBT movement in Hong Kong, or at least it turned a lot more high profile when that happened. And there were also other incidents before, so there have been a debate for a few years already. And something that, an important factor that influenced was that Hong Kong was at the same time passing a Bill of Rights.
Mm.
And part of the reason that why Hong Kong had to pass a Bill of Rights in particular at that time was in response to Tiananmen.
Oh,
because
right.
people were very concerned with human rights.
Which had happened in 1989,
yeah,
right?
It happened in 1989, yeah. So around those years, the main thing that the government was trying to do was to say that, oh, human rights in Hong Kong will be fine after the handover. They're trying to say it. So that's why they passed the Bill of Rights, which essentially incorporated the human rights obligations under the International Covenant for Civil and Political Rights, which is an international human rights treaty, which doesn't exactly apply in China.
Yeah.
so but it applies in Hong Kong. So so there are a few things that were, and so that was the kind of background right. in which criminalization was taken away.
So also just like as a reminder, right, like it's at the time Hong Kong was still under colonial rule, but there was like an agreement that Hong Kong would essentially be given back to China a few years later.
Yeah.
In, like the late 90s.
Yeah. So basically it was in 1984 that the UK and China agreed that, oh, we will hand over the sovereignty of Hong Kong back to China in 1997. And then there was, in the runoff to that year, there were a lot of fear of what would happen to Hong Kong. I think one of the important Western magazines had a cover saying that it's the death of Hong Kong, which...
But it's
the truth is.
I'm reading right now in my Chinese classes in Taiwan.
Yeah.
I'm reading a lot of publications from the 90s, actually the early 90s, by Taiwanese intellectuals.
Yeah.
And a lot of them have this where they're like, "Oh, we can't become a second Hong Kong."
Yeah.
So this is just before the handover, but in Taiwan, people are really scared and watching and like looking at Hong Kong very anxiously, right?
A lot of people interpret it so when UK and China agreed us to the sovereignty handover of Hong Kong, they agreed to something called the One Country, Two Systems principle, which is basically that Hong Kong will be handed over back to China, but Hong Kong will have its own system. So it will still run on capitalism. So bearing in mind that the 80s was still a Cold War era. So capitalism, it means everything that's not communist. So it means everything from a liberal or human rights society. And people also interpreted that as that it's an example for Taiwan to be unified with China.
Right.
So eventually, maybe if One Country, Two Systems is successful in Hong Kong, then maybe Taiwan would see that as a good way in which it can be unified with China. I don't think that recent events has shown that to be a plausible idea.
Yeah.
So
can you maybe give me a bit more of an idea of like historical LGBTQ activism in Hong Kong? You kind of said like the abolition of this paragraph. Was it 125 here as well, or I think it's paragraph 125 in India. But
it was 377 in India or Singapore, but it wasn't the same because Hong Kong doesn't actually have. It doesn't have the same criminal code, so it was different.
Okay.
I forgot the exact section number, but so it was in a run up to that in the 80s when this became more high profile, and then with the decriminalization happening in 91, and then everyone was talking about human rights in the early 90s.
Yeah.
And then, so some of the legislators, there was one legislator, Anna Wu, who introduced a bill, which is a wholesale discrimination law bill. So it sets up something called the Equal Opportunities Commission, and it will ban discrimination on grounds of race, sex, sexual orientation, disability.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a significant moment. But because it was a private bill, so it wasn't proposed by the government. It was proposed by a LegCo member, and
so
the government said,
"Legislative Council, LegCo is
LegCo
like
is
parliament.
The legislature, so it's like the parliament, except that the parliament and the executive is separated more clearly in Hong Kong than in parliamentary systems." So the government said that way, maybe not. And then they took over the legislation, and then they had their own versions of discrimination bill, which covered sex, disability, and family responsibility. Mm-hmm. So, for example, if you're a carer of a baby, or if you're a carer of an elderly, but it didn't include sexual orientation.
Mm.
And then there was a last ditch attempt before the handover in 1996. There was a private members' bill trying to pass a sexual orientation discrimination law, and it was defeated by 2 votes in Mexico. The government did something of consultation and say that, oh, there are 80% of the people who are opposed to this bill. But what they did is basically didn't actually go to what the submission said. They just counted the number of submissions that were against and for, and said, oh, there are 80% who are against. So they didn't actually scrutinize anything. So since that was defeated, 20 years on, nothing happened. So people have been trying to push for the same things.
Yeah.
People are trying to make the same demands. I've been involved in groups that are trying to draft legislative proposals, that attending forums to say why this is necessary. There have been times when the government seems to have been more open to having a consultation, but then eventually the government would say, oh, no, we're not doing that. This is too controversial.
Wow.
But then, at least in the past few years, we have survey results saying that 60%, at least 60% of the public is in favor of an anti-discrimination law. It's just that the government would still say that this is too controversial.
Right, yeah.
And this is the same thing. But then, at the same time, there have been court cases going on. So there have been bits and pieces that are being remedied by the courts. So for example, there was an unequal age of consent between heterosexual and homosexual sex.
Oh yeah, that's a thing that existed in a lot of countries.
Yeah,
right?
That existed in a lot of countries. So some people call decriminalization a partial decriminalization because the age of consent is still unequal.
Yeah.
So the court struck that down in 2005, and then there were other discrepancies or discrimination between against gay people in the law that was struck down later, and then in 2013. The court affirmed the right of a trans people who has undergone surgeries to marry a person of opposite sex.
Oh, yeah.
So they basically what that means is that if a trans woman has undergone all the surgeries, then you can be recognized as a woman and you can marry a man. But that doesn't mean same-sex marriage is open.
Yeah.
It's still opposite-sex marriage. It's just that we recognize you as a woman.
Yeah.
And the government also, and the court also told the government that you need to look into this area of law. We need to look into how the law recognizes a person's gender, because this is something that we need we need clarity. So this has been something that, this has been a recent
debate. So on this, what is it like if you're a transgender individual in Hong Kong, can you, for example, change your legal gender? Is that something that's possible?
So what happens is that everyone in Hong Kong carries a Hong Kong ID.
Mm-hmm.
So we have an ID card everyone has to carry. And if you're transgender, and you can change the gender on the Hong Kong ID only if you have undergone what they call a full set of sex reassignment surgeries. So what that means is that you have to remove your original genitals, you have to reconstruct your genitals of the sex that you desire to be. And basically that's what it means. And it's being challenged in courts now. So the courts are really the main venue where most of these policy changes or legal changes are being pushed forward, because the government simply doesn't want to do anything. But then even if you change the gender marker on your Hong Kong ID, that doesn't guarantee that you'll be treated as, say if you're a trans woman, it doesn't guarantee that you'll be treated as a woman in all areas of law, because there's no law that says that you have to treat a person like that.
Right, yeah. So that's what the discrimination law would address.
So that's what the discrimination law and something called the gender recognition law would address.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So, but also on the discrimination law, just to make sure I get this right, this means that essentially you're still fighting for issues that you were already fighting for 20 years ago, right?
Exactly.
Wow.
Yeah. So Leo, I was involved in a lobbying process last 2 years. Mm-hmm. It was a very minor right. So the government was trying to regulate private columbariums. So columbaria are basically where people store the ashes of deceased people.
Right.
And but in the past, because Hong Kong is small and they don't have enough public columbariums. So there are a lot of illegal private columbariums, which pose a lot of risks, because they basically are in unused industrial buildings and there's no regulation. So the government is very desperate to regulate them.
Wow.
And
that's wild.
Yeah. So, but then once you start to regulate them, what happens is that if you have to shut down an illegal columbarium, that means you have to return the ashes, right?
Yeah.
Okay. To the relatives. But in the initial proposal, the government only allows the return of ashes to opposite-sex spouses.
Mm.
So we were trying to ask for something very minor. We were saying that maybe you should also return the ashes to a living same-sex couple, or same-sex partner, because that is actually something really minor and that actually causes a lot of devastation. The government wasn't willing to do that initially, but then we were involved in a lot of lobbying. So I was personally involved in lobbying the government to change that. And we had surveys saying that, well, in every other issue concerning LGBT rights, we have like a lukewarm response. Except on this issue, we have 80% of the population behind us saying that, well, if your partner died, you should be able to get the ashes of your partner, regardless of whether it's same sex or opposite sex. But eventually what the government did was that, well, we'll open up a new category called related persons.
Mm-hmm.
And if none of the relatives, including none of your sons of your uncle or whatever of deceased, if none of them show up, then you may get it.
Wow.
So that's the kind of progress that we can call. Is that, well, we'll give you some rights, but we'll not give you full equality, even when the population has shown to be before us, to be behind us.
Yeah.
So,
that regard also, is there any way in which same-sex partnerships are recognized in any way, like a civil partnership that you have in a lot of other countries?
We don't have civil partnerships, apart from the piecemeal, for example, the ashes, the columbarium thing, which to some extent recognize same-sex partners. The only area where same-sex partner is really recognized is in domestic violence. So a same-sex cohabiting couple and an opposite-sex cohabiting couple can, if they were a victim of domestic violence, they can apply for an injunction or sue their partner. But that was after a very long and hard fight,
right,
in which I still remember, because that debate happened when I was in high school, and there were a lot of vitriol in the press. There were ministers coming out and saying that, oh, this bill will lead to prostitution, it will lead to male prostitutes claiming that they are same sex partners, and they are priests that compare homosexuality to prostitution and cancer.
Wow.
And drug users. So even that was the product of a very long and hard fight, in which there were a lot of prejudice that was revealed. And it wasn't extremely clear that the public was behind us, except that we were lucky, because the domestic violence bill was supported by a lot of women's groups and a lot of feminist groups. And they were very much in favor of including same-sex couples.
Yeah.
So we had their support.
Right, so it's like you had like a broader coalition.
We had a broader alliance and coalition. Yeah.
That's really helpful.
Yeah.
And so one thing also, because this might be worth clarifying, you mentioned the stricter separation between the legislative and the executive in Hong Kong. So your executive isn't exactly elected, right? When you vote, your votes only elect the representatives in the Legislative Council.
Yes.
Is that correct?
Yeah, but it's not like it's a so in a parliamentary system, you also vote for members of parliament, and you don't exactly directly vote for the prime minister, because then the prime minister in a parliamentary system is is produced among the parliament.
Right,
so the leader of either party will be...
Well, so like in Germany, right?
Yeah,
like
in Germany.
Like the parties, like the parties that manage to form a coalition that like gets like 50% of parliamentary votes, they will be able to like elect the chancellor.
Exactly. So, but the thing in Hong Kong is that we can only elect half of our parliament, and the chief executive, which is basically the is not selected from the parliament. The chief executive is elected separately and is elected by a committee of 1,200 people. And that committee is not elected.
Right.
That committee, some of them are elected as district councillors and they are representatives of district councils. Most of them, they are representatives of the insurance industry, they're representatives of the agricultural industry, which is hardly existent in Hong Kong. And some of them are simply people appointed by Beijing. And that is a kind of committee that selects the chief executive.
Right.
And for the parliament, we only elect half of them. The other half is by what we call functional constituencies.
Oh, yeah.
So what that means is, again, the insurance industry will have a representative the agricultural industry will have a representative in the parliament. And that may sound something like the UK, House of Lords, House of Commons, except that they have equal voting powers.
Right, yeah.
So, and which means that whenever the government wants to pass a bill, it only needs a simple majority from the parliament. And they will always have half of them on their
because
side.
They always get these
because they always have these functional constituencies on their sides.
Wow.
Because the functional constituencies, they are voted by, some of them are not even voted by people.
Mm.
They're voted by corporations,
right, yeah.
Which are bound to vote in favor of the government.
Yeah.
So that means that when the government wants to pass something, they're bound to have half of the house on their side. And but when a legislative member, when a parliament member wants to pass something, it needs to pass both the directly elected members and the functional constituencies.
Right, yeah.
And it will never pass the functional constituencies unless the government wants them to pass.
Right, yeah.
Which means the unelected chief executive, which leads the government, has basically a wholesale control of whatever bill it wants to pass in the legislature.
Yeah.
And in a few years back then, there was a legislative member who is from the pro-democracy parties, and she put in a motion saying that we should hold a public consultation for an anti-discrimination law on grounds of sexual orientation. And that was supported by over half of the legislature, but it was voted down because the functional constituencies didn't support it.
Yeah.
So that highlights the intricacies between the lack of a democracy and lack of progress on LGBT rights.
Right, yeah. And which is also the reason why a lot of the things that you're talking about, the progress, it's happening in the courts, right?
Yeah.
Because there you can
kind of
you can refer to the basic law and say, well, look, these are things that...
Yeah, because the government is in control of the parliament, and if the government doesn't want to do anything, it doesn't have to do anything.
Right.
And there's no way to really lobby effectively against the government because we have no way to elect government
as well. Exactly.
So
it might be easy to say that, well, Hong Kong is part of China and the China courts aren't independent. Are the courts in Hong Kong independent?
The courts in Hong Kong are independent. I think the courts in Hong Kong are independent.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why there have been a lot of progress in the courts, even when the government doesn't want it. There have been a lot of progress in the courts on LGBT rights because the courts, they themselves, they say that the basic law, the constitution, international human rights treaties, they demand equality. It's only when Beijing doesn't want something to happen, then they will say that now we interpreted the basic law. The basic law is the constitution of Hong Kong, but it's also a national law of the PRC. So it's in a very weird status.
Yeah.
We treat it as a constitution. Beijing treats it as just one of its laws. So when Beijing doesn't want something to happen, then it will issue an interpretation of the basic law, not allowing that to happen. That hasn't happened very frequently. It has happened six times in the past 20 years of the handover. But every time it happens, it's related to something that's very central to the political system of Hong Kong. So, for example, the democratic reforms, for example, the first two was about who has the residency rights in Hong Kong. And there was the recent one was about the qualification of elected lawmakers and whether they will be disqualified when they don't take the oath that, correctly.
An oath that includes saying that Hong Kong is part of China.
Yeah,
right?
An oath that includes saying Hong Kong is part of China. So if Beijing doesn't want something to happen, it has the means to do it.
Right. But in practice, that doesn't happen a lot.
In practice, that doesn't happen a lot, although every time it happens, it creates a lot of furor, at least at least within the legal community, because every time they do it, they do it very differently from what courts in Hong Kong do. They don't exactly provide the reasons, and they don't exactly conform to the limits of what the language of the Basic Law can bear, and
quite free interpretations.
Yeah, they are very free spirit in their interpretation, so. So whenever that happens, we find that the law just doesn't guide anything because you can interpret four words into three pages of entirely unrelated content.
Right, yeah.
That happens. But in terms of LGBT rights, it doesn't seem that this is something that bothers Beijing a lot.
Right.
So I do not personally think that they will interpret the basic law to ban something, any progress on LGBT rights. So I do think that currently courts in Hong Kong still have the power to independently say, determine whether LGBT rights in Hong Kong are demanded by the constitution. So that's a good sign.
Yeah. So in that sense, if you look at it that way, how likely do you think, for example, that civil partnerships might be recognized in Hong Kong, or that even same-sex marriage is something that might happen? Do these things, like, as in, if you had to give me a time horizon, what do you think, when is it realistic?
I think on this issue, I differ a lot from a lot of my peers, because the thing is, because Hong Kong has always been in this difficulty to mobilize people, because it seems that nothing people can actually do to convince the government to do something. So a lot of people, including a lot of people in the gay community, they don't think anything can actually be done. But I actually differ, because when I read the court's judgment, when I look at the court, I see that they want to do something. And they have held, for example, recently in a few areas that, for example, in benefits for civil service, or immigration, they have held that you have to recognize same-sex couples.
Right, weren't there a few court cases where same-sex spouses wanted to be able to stay in Hong Kong?
Yeah. So there have been, for example, there is a recent case in which there was a British lesbian couple, and one of them has a working visa in Hong Kong, so she is a resident in Hong Kong. She wants to apply to have her partner come to Hong Kong as well on a dependent visa, which is very much like what every other common law country does. But then the Director of Immigration didn't allow that, because they say that the dependency visa is only allowed for spouses, and spouses only include opposite sex couples. So the British couple went to court, and they asked the court does this violate the constitution? Does this violate the right to equality? And the court actually said, initially, the first instance court said it doesn't, but then they appealed, and the appeal court said it does. So the appeal court judgment basically says that apart from the core benefits of marriage, which they didn't exactly explain very well, but apart from the core benefits, we see no reason why any other right should be restricted on sexual orientation grounds. That judgment is still being appealed. We will see what happens. But from what I see in the courts in the past, courts are relatively liberal on this area. They have a strong tradition in equality rights. Not as strong as I would like them to be, but because I'm a discrimination lawyer, but they are I can see a possibility, a very live possibility, that they will say that you actually need something like a civil partnership.
Right. Yeah.
To say, to at least to say which areas of law will be equal between same sex and different sex couples, and which areas of law won't.
And so also what you just said, right? Like, it's very, if the court said that, well, same-sex couples can't have the core benefits of marriage, but they can have, like, other non-core benefits, and it's like, what is the, it's not clear what the difference between those two things is.
Then it
is,
goes
right?
to what the difference is.
Exactly.
And then that's, but that will be a kind of progress, because eventually the court might find that actually there aren't really any justification for limiting the core benefits as well. But then we need time for that, but at least I think something like a civil partnership scheme, but it won't give full equality. It will might actually be quite far from full equality, but something like a civil partnership scheme, I personally think that it's on the horizon.
Right. Yeah. So it's also interesting because this is exactly how it happened in Taiwan, right? Because in Taiwan, the government was very reluctant to do anything on same-sex marriage, and it's just kind of like lawmakers didn't really want to touch it, and so the courts actually said it violates the constitution to not give same-sex couples the same rights, and so you have to do this, right?
I think to some extent it might be a little bit similar to Germany as well. I think it was also the German courts that actually had a lot of cases on same-sex couples,
right,
and and what kind of benefits they can have, and so that the rights of same-sex couples in Germany, I think, also expanded along throughout the years with court's interpretation.
And there were people who actually said that what was interesting about Germany is that because of all this litigation, some people said that same-sex couples almost exactly had already almost had the same rights as opposite-sex couples. It's just that they were not given the official name of marriage.
Yeah.
Right? And so like, there were people who actually argued, well, then why do you still want this marriage thing? Like, just leave us alone. So like, it was kind of like, similarly, again, like, politicians could kind of say that they didn't actually have same-sex marriage, while de facto a lot of their rights were already being granted.
Well, I think Hong Kong is still far from that stage.
Yeah.
I think even if we have anything like a civil partnership, it will be quite far from a full equal rights, even in terms of the rights accorded. So I think we're still some time before that can happen. But I do think something like that will have to happen, because otherwise we will just have court cases keep coming. And one of the things that an unelected government, which is dominated by civil service and bureaucrats, what they hate is uncertainty. So they might want something that's certain.
So are there any other cases right now that are maybe being litigated or that are pending somewhere?
Oh, there
that
are many.
Think that is like, are like worth it paying attention to, where you think something might be decided in this regard?
Yeah, there are many cases. There's also, apart from the immigration case, there's also another case where there was a civil servant. So he married his partner in New Zealand, and so he fought for equal spousal benefits for his same-sex partner. So that actually won in first instance. Then he also fought for the right to file tax and to have the benefits of I think spousal allowances. That encountered a little bit of a technical issue, so it didn't actually win in first instance court, but it was because of a technical issue rather than.
So if someone else sued again, then they
might. So so there are more and more of these cases, and we can see more of them coming in other areas of law. And there's also progress on trans rights. So there's a case that's litigating now, challenging the requirements for trans people to undergo what we call, what I just called the full sex reassignment surgeries. So that requirement is now being challenged in court. Actually, I think it was just heard a few weeks ago. We are quite optimistic of where that would be going, because we have a lot of stuff. We have a lot of authorities behind the challenge. We have the European Court of Human Rights that just ruled that this kind of requirement is violates human rights. Mm. We have the UN Committee Against Torture specifically recommending the Hong Kong government to remove this kind of requirements. So we have done a lot to show the courts and the government that actually what you're doing is really not good. And eventually it might end up in a court case that's in favor of us.
Right. Yeah. So to what extent, I feel like, okay, I can see why you would refer to like the UN, because it's like a international body. To what extent To what extent does it make sense to, for example, refer to the European Court of Human Rights, like to non-Hong Kong courts? Like, what is the importance of that?
I think Hong Kong courts are actually quite receptive of the European Court of Human Rights and basically international and comparative human rights jurisprudence, except on political rights.
Right.
But apart from that, the Hong Kong courts they readily. Listen to arguments based on those cases. They read those judgments and they give reasons on why they accept and why they don't. And sometimes they give very good reasons for departing from them. Sometimes they give not so good reasons for departing from them. But generally, it is persuasive. Mm-hmm. So we use them a lot in courts. So it is helpful. And the UN is. It depends on what kind of things we get from them. But, for example, I've been personally involved in a lot of UN advocacy. The Committee Against Torture, which I just mentioned, actually the meeting of the Committee Against Torture that issued that recommendation, I was personally at that meeting. And so this is the kind of ways that we try to contribute and try to make the government listen,
right.
Is to try to get all kinds of other pressure and all kinds of other authorities saying that what you're doing right now is actually not okay.
Right.
And sometimes that works, sometimes that doesn't.
But it's interesting because I think a lot of people, when you kind of talk to people who are very pessimistic about politics, they might often say that the UN doesn't really do anything. But this is a very good example of like a very real impact that things like that can have.
It will never lead to an immediate change, but we just have to do it because it's not like we have a lot of other things we can do. So
that's also true.
Yeah, so we have to do it, and sometimes it will lead to some kind of change, and sometimes it doesn't lead to an immediate change, but it helps in how we articulate our policies as well. So, for example, again, the Committee Against Torture, which oversees the Convention Against Torture, which Hong Kong is a party to. Actually, I think most of the world except North Korea is a party to that convention. And so, apart from the recommendation on trans people, we also got a recommendation on intersex people, which is very interesting because that helped a lot of intersex people in Hong Kong. That helped a lot in intersex activism in Hong Kong because they have a footing to say what the government doing is wrong.
Yes.
They have something to say that is wrong, and it gives them a bit of legitimacy apart from their own experience and their own advocacy. So that's how they use it to generate dialogue, to generate attention. So that kind of contribution also helps. And interestingly, that kind of work really highlights how sometimes the advocacy of sexual and gender minorities, they're actually really interlinked internationally, because this recommendation on intersex people, it was actually first issued in relation to Germany.
Oh.
So the Committee Against Torture actually issued this recommendation in relation to Switzerland and Germany back in 2013 or something like that. And then it made a similar recommendation to some other country. And that was largely because of the really strong advocacy of intersex groups in Geneva and European intersex groups. And then the recommendation to Hong Kong on intersex people's rights was actually the first time the committee issued a similar recommendation outside of Europe.
Oh.
So you can see how solidarity happens.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because it it really helps a lot.
So did you specifically ask for the recommendation? You kind of like approach the committee and like tell, to essentially explain to them the
situation. It's the same thing we do. We give the submissions, and in submissions we highlight what you have given to other countries in the past.
Okay.
We highlight the evidence that this the same thing is happening in Hong Kong.
Right.
And when we attend the meeting, we try to represent and we try to submit to the committee that this is an area of tension that you need to pay attention to. And eventually the committee came up with the same recommendation.
Yeah.
So it was work. It was a lot of resource because you have to fly to Geneva to do that.
Oh, yeah.
But I think that is a really good example of how UN advocacy might be able to change something on the ground.
So one thing on like a slightly different, it's kind of like a slightly different angle. One thing that I'm curious about is often when I talk to people in Hong Kong about LGBTQ rights, I hear that there's like people who are not maybe as directly involved as you are say that they have the impression that LGBTQ activism kind of like gets kind of forgotten because there are other issues that take the forefront, like where a lot of like political issues and like combating Chinese influence in Hong Kong, or people who like fight for democracy directly, they're like, well, these are like our main issues, and that draws more attention. Is that something that you?
I think that definitely happens because the 2 years in UK, I get a sense that LGBT rights are actually quite in the forefront of political issues, or at least if someone says something homophobic, it gets headlines.
Right. Yeah. It's like news.
It's news. Whereas in Hong Kong, if the person is homophobic but he's not overtly homophobic, or at least if what he says is not ridiculously wrong, then that's just get passed as something that happens. That just happens. And even when we the Hong Kong politics is largely divided into the pro-government and the pro-democracy side. And even among the pro-democracy side, we don't get a unified support for LGBT rights because there are a lot of people who either because of their religious belief or either because they come from relatively traditional backgrounds or they're not exactly used to this. So we don't even get a unified support from that, even though the pro-democracy party is supposed to be grounded in human rights.
Right, and it's supposed to, but it's also interesting because it's similar to Taiwan, right? Where the traditional left-right spectrum doesn't necessarily say everything you need to know about Hong Kong politics because there is the China-Hong Kong angle, right? So while the Democratic Party, Pan-Democrats, they're technically like the progressives. They are the progressives because they oppose kind of like mainland influence.
Yeah,
right?
So it's more complicated than that, and it's not common that I don't think it ever happens that a party would put LGBT rights into its forefront and say that you should elect us because we're pro LGBT rights. It's not going to be one of the key demands. It's going to be something that's on the back. It's going to be a bonus.
So how is it like among young people? So one thing that I thought was interesting is when Jackie Chan's daughter, I think, was it? Who came out as lesbian. Was it?
Gigi Chow?
Yeah, maybe.
A Hong Kong celebrity.
Yeah, there was a Hong Kong celebrity who came out like very... Yeah. Like, I think she was famous because she was the daughter of some famous actor.
Right.
But so when I read about that, like she talked about, like it was like the, she posted like an Instagram of her and her girlfriend.
Is it also Wong, Wong Fei?
No, I don't think so.
Okay. Maybe Jackie Chan.
I think it was like, he had like cheated with, this goes into too much detail. He had like cheated and had her with like a wife who he had, didn't actually live with or something like
that. Right, okay.
But the more important point is kind of like this girl came out very publicly.
Yeah.
And there was kind of like a lot of backlash, but also a lot of support, like when she shared like this white Instagram post. So one thing, like this Instagram post, so one thing that I'm wondering is like, how do you perceive this amongst young people? Like, to what extent are LGBTQ issues such a topic of conversation?
I think that's again what I alluded to earlier, is that people generally think that we are young, we're liberal, we're open-minded, so we should accept gay people, but then it's still very superficial, so it doesn't mean that they won't, it doesn't mean that they would actually be friends with gay people. It doesn't actually mean that they...
Wait, so they might not be friends with someone because they're gay?
Well, you will still hear the same kind of prejudice or the same kind of homophobic statements, even though they claim that they're not homophobic.
Right.
And they may not be genuinely homophobic because there isn't... there still isn't too many people who have come out. So if you haven't encountered a gay person in your life, then you're bound to have a lot of prejudice and homophobia, right?
So, yeah, that's true.
So that still happens. But if you ask them whether they support LGBT rights, they would say yes.
Mm.
But it doesn't necessarily mean that they know a lot of gay people or they understand issues very well. So that's the situation now. But it is getting better because the support and the acceptance is growing, at least among young people. And I think one very strong factor that really, really is happening is that they see that countries that they see are democratic and they see are liberal, they have progress on LGBT rights. So they have the same thing, same imagination. Oh, if Hong Kong claims to be open and democratic, if Hong Kong claims to be westernized or cosmopolitan, then we should have the same. But it's not exactly the healthiest way of thinking this.
Yeah.
So
is there... There is a pride in Hong Kong, right? A pride march.
Yeah.
But is it like, I know it's smaller than Taipei because Taipei is the biggest, the biggest in Asia. But
I think it has less than 10,000 every year.
Oh wow, that's not a lot.
Yeah, that's still quite a lot. But so pride in Hong Kong is much less fun than pride anywhere else. I've been to London Pride, I've been to New York Pride, and pride in Hong Kong is just a lot more boring. But but it's more like a march.
Right.
In Hong Kong, because I guess one obvious reason is because we don't have all the progress that all these other countries have. So the pride in Hong Kong is a lot less celebratory.
Right.
Although I think that you don't have to be celebratory to be fun.
Yeah.
You can have more fun.
You just up the fun when good things happen.
But so that is the case. But then you can see in Taipei that is very different. So in Taiwan you can see a huge pride. A lot of people in Hong Kong actually fly to Taipei to attend the pride. It's really fun. It's not single-sidedly celebratory because I know the organizers of the Taipei Pride, they're very nuanced in their thinking. They're very strategic and they know what they want to demand, and sometimes their demands are quite radical. So there's actually a lot we learn, or we try to learn, from Taiwanese democracy and Taiwanese LGBT advocacy, and basically anything that's progressive from Taiwan, we try to learn a lot from them, because we somehow see them as an example and as what, even though we share a similar culture or we share a similar written language, they seem to have done everything that's better than us. So we're trying to learn.
Yeah, this is something that I found interesting when I went to Taipei Pride, is that when I talk to people, often like I came across people and I was like, well, why are you here? And then people tell me things like, I want that everyone can express their gender according to who they are and their identity. And I was like, whoa.
That's a lot more.
That's
a lot more understanding than the average person on the street.
Yeah, like you pick like a random person, and there were like 100, more than 100,000 people last year, right? And like you pick a random person and they like come up with this really like pretty like progressive understanding of what LGBTQ activism is supposed to be like, and that's really impressive.
I think in the past, I think that has one thing that really has to be factored in is the fact that they have had a quick transformation from being under a dictatorship to a democracy. And what I hear from the activists there is that in those years, human rights and freedom of expression, these concepts were very strongly rooted because they've just had this transformation. So when you have the banner of human rights behind you, it gets a lot easier to be accepted into the mainstream political agenda. Whereas the same isn't applicable in Hong Kong, because although we claim to have human rights protection, we claim to have a Bill of Rights, but the government in Hong Kong isn't exactly going to put human rights in its forefront.
And there's not maybe the same amount of public pressure.
Yeah, it's not the same. So, and Taiwan also has a long history of, for example, LGBT people being intermingled into the democracy movement. And they have that side as well. And I know the LGBT groups in Taiwan, they are very involved in other advocacies as well. So they are very well connected. They have very good alliances with other groups. Whereas in Hong Kong, we're just starting to catch up on that. Although we've always, I think the Hong Kong LGBT movement has always tried to be allied to the democracy movement, but that has its own. That's quite double-edged because on one side you get more support from mainstream politics. On the other side, the government doesn't exactly like that.
So
it's different.
Since we're already kind of like coming to the comparative part. Can you said you tried to learn from the activists in Taiwan. Can you maybe talk a bit more about like what that looks like?
I think the really important thing is what I just said about alliances,
right,
because
yeah.
they are really so good at building alliances, and that's why that's what we're trying to build here
yeah.
as well. So whenever we have a petition or we have a submission, then we try to draw in our organizations not just working for LGBT. We also circulate it to feminist groups, we also circulate to disability groups,
yeah.
we also circulate to other groups, and we're trying to build more alliances and more a stronger culture of working together.
Right.
On the other side is that is not so much about strategies, but the fact that they are progressing so far mm-hmm. ahead. We bring up that along.
Yeah.
Because whenever people say that you guys are a bunch of westernized ideologies, we can say that, look at Taiwan.
Yeah,
it's not westernized. This is something that's universal. There's gay people everywhere.
Yeah.
And I think that's the strongest testament
right.
to the fact that LGBT rights are not westernized. And we still, in fact, in my own advocacy, I try to use that a lot as well. I try to establish why, when I write submissions or whatever, I try to say that it's not just the European court or the American court that says that. There are also courts in Latin America. There are also courts in in South Africa that have said the same. So it's not something that's westernized. So we try to use that a lot as well. And also the other thing that we learned from Taiwan is their radical roots.
Mm.
Because even though they have a lot of success on marriage equality, there is a very good atmosphere of queer theory, radical theories,
yeah.
that really inform their advocacy. Whereas in Hong Kong, we're still, we also have that, but it doesn't marry very well with the message that we try to get through always, because they can express those messages. It seems that they can express these radical messages in more acceptable ways.
Mm.
Or in smart ways,
yeah.
whereas we're trying to learn that, because whenever in Hong Kong we're trying to say something radical, it just sounds very dry. It just sounds like we're speaking from a textbook,
yeah.
or we're just reciting what Judith Butler says. so it's not exactly very welcoming. But then I think in Hong Kong, on the other hand, we have our fair share of progressive and radical groups as well. So for example, I think in Hong Kong, there are very progressive advocacy for sex workers.
Mm-hmm.
They are progressive advocacy for transgender sex workers, for example. So this is the kind of area that we also think that, oh, this is something that we have and
right.
we treasure. So so that's the kind of things that we constantly learn from each other.
And so, having talked about the comparison kind of to Taiwan, how would you say the Hong Kong situation compares to like mainland China? And to what extent is there something where do you like cooperate? Do you learn from each other? Or because we talked about this earlier, right? Like the CCP and the mainland China has a certain influence over Hong Kong.
Yeah. So what happens in mainland China is as far as I understand it,
mm-hmm.
the interesting thing is, to some extent, there's less of a staunch opposition to LGBT rights in mainland China than in Hong Kong, because mainland China doesn't have the influence of churches.
Right.
Whereas in Hong Kong, we have influence of churches. We have a colonial legacy where churches dominate a lot in education and social services. So we have, in Hong Kong, we have churches that has influence on on the government, a disproportionate influence on the government. In mainland China, they don't have that. So that's an area which they fare better than we do. But they also have an even stronger Confucian culture and the culture of families. So they have an even stronger culture of that. And they also can't necessarily appeal to human rights very well.
Yeah.
Because It's not that they can't articulate human rights. It's just that that kind of discourse is even less welcome.
Yeah, it's a very sensitive issue
in mainland China
right.
than in Hong Kong. So, and they also have difficulty in freedom of association. They also have difficulty in challenging the government through courts. So that's all the different institutional conditions that Hong Kong still has an edge over them. But mainland activists they have been very resilient, and they have been operating under difficult conditions, but I think sometimes they actually have amazing results.
Right.
For example, they have a recent case where transgender discrimination. The court actually accepted a case of transgender discrimination, and even in Hong Kong we haven't really had that yet. So,
right, yeah.
So the way in which they lobby a government that is even less democratic than ours, but they have achieved something, is quite worthy of note. But in terms of actual strategies and learning from each other, I think this is something that's still being explored, because in Hong Kong we still think we have more to learn from a more liberal system in Taiwan than from an even more oppressive system in mainland China. But as Hong Kong becomes less liberal, we might have more to learn from mainland China and how they work. So, and in some sense, as I said, because of the lack of the religious factor in mainland China, sometimes their advocacies are sometimes more effective, and they have to try ways to ground the advocacy on more so-called indigenous values or Chinese values. And whereas in Hong Kong, sometimes it's easy for us to resort to saying that Hong Kong is westernized, that's why we should have LGBT rights. But that's a kind of discourse that we're also trying to rectify or supplement.
Right. So the idea is then to kind of like paint LGBTQ rights more of a Hong Kong thing or a universal right rather than something that comes from the West.
Yeah, I think that's important. But also important to say that we can't do that and sacrificing the human rights approach, because we're still in an alliance with all other human rights issues that we're trying to get through. We're not just concerned about gay rights, right?
Cool. I think that's it for me in terms of questions. There's already quite a bit. Sorry. One last question. So, do you have, if someone was interested in kind of following the development of LGBTQ rights in Hong Kong, are there any particular media outlets you'd recommend them to follow, or any organizations that are worth keeping an eye on in particular?
I think English speaking. Forums. There are a few groups that is mainly English speaking. One of them is Pink Alliance.
Okay.
I think there's also a Dim Sum magazine.
Dim Sum magazine.
Yeah, it's called the Dim Sum magazine. I don't know if it actually still operates.
I'll look into it.
Yeah. But then, I think more generally, Hong Kong Free Press. It's more general. Hong Kong Free Press is more general political developments, but they also have a great coverage on LGBT issues. So that's the kind of avenues that you can follow. And I think because the fact is that Hong Kong LGBT rights is still very, very connected with its wider politics. So it's to understand why LGBT rights get progress or get stalled in Hong Kong, it's necessary to get a bit of context.
Right, yeah.
So following a general press, an English-speaking press, is helpful for getting that context.
Yeah. Awesome. Beyond that, is there anything else you think I forgot or anything else you want to add? This is quite comprehensive.
No, it's okay. I think it's just important to just highlight that LGBT rights in non-Western contexts have its own dynamics, but ultimately it has a universal roots, because it's based on the same kinds of sexuality and characteristics that we all have, and as much as we try to develop strategies that are native to Hong Kong, native to Asia, or East Asia, there's a lot of solidarity that can be important from elsewhere. So it's important to bear that in mind.
Well, awesome. Thank you so much for making time.